Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we're opening this morning with our friends from Junior Achievement of Greater Fairfield County. We're going to be talking about a couple of recent national JA surveys released during November, which is National Entrepreneurship Month. And we're going to hear about a month-long program called Launch Lessons that are going to bring a trio of local entrepreneurs out to speak with students about the possibilities and opportunities awaiting them in our gig economy. Then we're going to visit with a Connecticut physician who's a researcher and national spokesperson for the American Lung Association. Yes, November is also Lung Cancer Awareness Month, and we'll be learning about a new groundbreaking screening process that can help save the lives of the nearly 3,000 people diagnosed with the deadly disease lung cancer in Connecticut every year. And we'll close heading up to Hartford to invite you to explore or reacquaint yourself with the magical and educational Mark Twain House and Museum, and consider enjoying the sights and sounds of the holidays by attending the Friends of the Mark Twain House and Museum's 38th annual house tour coming up next weekend on December 2nd. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. Area Congregations Together and the Spooner House, which serves homeless veterans, individuals, and families in crisis throughout the greater Naugatuck Valley, has launched its annual Frozen Turkey and Fixings Drive for holiday meal baskets, and that continues through mid-December. Last year, the Spooner House Food Bank served 4,400 holiday meals. Spooner House is asking everyone to be as generous as possible and thanks all in advance for any help they're able to provide. Food items can always be dropped at the Spooner House, 30 Todd Road in Shelton, Monday through Friday from 9 to 5. There's also staff on duty 24/7, and you can contact the supervisor on duty to arrange a donation delivery at 203-225-0453. Or if you missed any of the information, just visit actspooner.org for other donation locations and updates. It's always great when we can open the program visiting with our friends at Junior Achievement. And during the month of November, JA of Greater Fairfield County is working with several local entrepreneurs who are going to share their experience and ignite the entrepreneurial spark among students with something called the JA Launch Lesson. And with our guests, Bernadine Vendito, she is president of JA of Greater Fairfield County. Also in the room with her is Jennifer Murphy Pitcher, and she's a district director with JA, and she oversees programming. So, Bernadine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. We're excited about the opportunity to speak with you.
So, did this survey actually originate at JA of Fairfield County?
No, it didn't originate. It originated as a work with Ernst & Young and Junior Achievement USA.
Okay.
Ernst & Young has a national partnership with us. And as you see, based on the data, they are very interested in sharing information on this topic.
Yeah, so this was a pretty significant survey. 1,000 teens were consulted on this. Can you talk a little bit more about what you know about the survey and why you think it's really, really important information for both young people and their parents and caregivers and educators, for that matter, to consider at this time?
Sure. The survey itself is a good sampling. Like I said, it's national, and it's a sampling of different areas. So we're able to get some good information from it. And basically, we find that there is an interest. And then, as you see, there is a need, though, to give these kids more information, because the more that they learn about the challenges, the more that they learn about how to go about successfully launching a business, they're able to achieve success. And this fits with the JA. It's one of our major pillars is entrepreneurship. It's what JA was founded upon.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're able to, and the other piece is it's incredibly important because we're able to provide the opportunities for these kids to connect with entrepreneurs and people who have started their own business to get firsthand role models, firsthand success, stories, failure stories, so that the kids really get a comprehensive understanding before they launch into this type of career.
Very good. Can we make sure you're right on the mouthpiece, Bernadine? We were losing you there just a little bit. It's one thing, I guess, to say we're here in 2018, rapidly approaching 2019. We're deeply entrenched in a gig economy. But it's another thing to both identify with opportunities in the gig economy in terms of entrepreneurship, and to launch that. It was kind of interesting to see that at least according to the survey, a measurable percentage of teen boys had already started a business, and 4% of girls as well.
Yes, it really is exciting to see that the entrepreneurial spirit really is alive and moving. And, at Junior Achievement, we actually start to talk about that from a young age. I mean, in fourth grade, they're learning more about it. In first grade, they're learning about the word and what it means. And through the activities Junior Achievement presents, they're starting to think about, if I started a business, where would I put that business? Which are really thoughtful questions and open their minds to the entrepreneurial concept. Mm. Something that we're doing locally is recognizing, as you said, there's a lower percentage of females, but with exposure, we think that that will increase as well. We do a program called Biz Day, and it launched last year, was the first year, in partnership with Peoples and Pullman Comley Female Leadership, which exposed girls to leadership, but also a panel of women who, some of them were entrepreneurs.
Well, what I was going to say is, 25 plus years ago, when I first got interested in Junior Achievement as a movement, the thing that was most inspiring to me was learning that, in fact, you folks were not only in the schools, but were actually interacting with kids in the kindergarten, first and second grade range to really kind of plant the seed for them to start thinking about this. And it's great to hear that that initiative not only continues to exist, but is so much greatly expanded today. And that, I have to believe that a lot of the people who are now your kind of diplomats who are out there, including these entrepreneurs that are going to be working around Connecticut for these launch lessons that we're going to be talking about, may in fact have been among those young people who were on the grounds that the seeds were thrown back, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago by JA itself.
Yes, that's such a great point and true. In fact, last Thursday, we had our first event as a merged organization, now Greater Fairfield County, which is all of Fairfield County and the Valley. And we had a student speak who was an alumni of in-class program. And to your point, he talked about his own career and that he launched his own business. And, was grateful to Junior Achievement. The role modeling in particular was incredibly valuable to him, to have a person to connect with and be a mentor to him, as well as learning the valuable experiences of what does it feel like when you're trying to run a business. And that's what Junior Achievement does, is really provide that hands-on opportunity and experience.
And that reflects more of what the survey, the national survey, has shown. More than 10 out of 100 of the adults who were surveyed said they started their first business at or before they were 18.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit more and drill in to a little bit more of these statistics, because there is still that fear of failure factor that is hampering, or at least a point of consideration when young people are starting to form ideas about what they want to do for the rest of their lives. A significant number of those surveyed who expressed fear of failure, and this, I guess, is where the launch lessons come in, right?
Yes, exactly. And the role model piece. So the launch lessons are a great opportunity for a group of those kids to hear from local entrepreneurs, and you see in this some of the ones that we have going out to the schools, and to talk to the kids about the fact that many of them may have failed their first attempts, and then what they did and what it took to stay with it. And, you know, oftentimes you'll hear them say, it's not just having a passion for something, but it's learning what are the tools that I need, learning what are the real business skills that you need to develop or who you need to connect with. So that's why it's so important. It's not just a concept of, oh, be passionate about it and it'll work out. It's how do we make this work if it's the right thing? And how do we go down a path of success? So the piece that Junior Achievement offers is that connectivity and the role modeling of entrepreneurs is what's so incredibly important and can help with this fear of failure for sure.
Yeah, that's having that entrepreneurial mentorship, which is so important and is also reflected in the survey. So many of the individuals that turned a profit in their own businesses were guided or sought advice from either a current or former colleague or an entrepreneurial mentor of some sort. So about 3 or 4 minutes that we have left to talk with you, folks, if you're just tuning in, we're visiting with Bernadine Vendito, who is the president of Junior Achievement of Greater Fairfield County on the occasion of the release of a national survey about entrepreneurship, and to talk a little bit about an exciting new program happening out of JA of Fairfield County here during National Entrepreneurship Month in November, which are called Launch Lessons. So in this last few minutes that we have with you, Bernadine, tell us a little bit about what these young people are going to be experiencing in this incredible flock of entrepreneurial mentors who are going to be fanning out across Fairfield County to talk about it.
And thank you, John. I'm going to have Jennifer speak to that because she works most closely with them on the front lines.
Excellent. Jennifer. Very good. Jennifer Murphy Pitcher. Yes, hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Jennifer Murphy Pitcher is the district director and oversees programming for JA of Fairfield County. So as I was saying to Bernadine, a worthy crop of entrepreneurial mentors is going to be spreading out across Fairfield County here during November. Tell us a little bit about what's going to be going on.
Yeah, so it's very exciting. One of the first speakers we have going in, Hannah Perry, started a business called The Giggling Pig, and it's an art studio. She has two locations, one in Shelton, Connecticut, and one in Bethel, Connecticut. And so she actually came from the corporate world and decided, you know what, I just want to follow my passion, and opened up these two painting studios for children. So she just talks to the kids a little bit about, you know, kind of what her education level is, what her corporate role is, and why she decided to go into business for herself. So some of the benefits of being in business for herself. And then, you know, making the decision to open up a second studio, right? So you have this really great studio in her hometown where she lives, and the, you know, reaching out into a brand new community was mm-hmm. challenging, yeah. But and just how she was successful in doing that.
Right, and I'll stop you there because so coincidental that Lucy Voves, who is the founder and president of Churchill Classics, who's a specialty picture frame manufacturer in Monroe, was just a guest during Manufacturing Month here on our program just a few weeks ago. So she is going to be part of the visit of students and will probably be sharing a lot of the information that she talked about with us here on For the People at Bunnell and Stratford High Schools in Stratford. But then there's Devon Scanlon. Tell us a bit about Devon.
Perfect. So Devon actually also came from the corporate world. She was an event coordinator for a very prestigious golf club. And she wanted to get her family back to Brookfield, which is where she grew up. Mm-hmm. And she started to look at different businesses and knew she wanted to open and run her own business and work for herself. And so her story is very unique. It's kind of about why she decided on trying to open up a Chick-fil-A franchise. She was one of 25,000 people that applied to open up a Chick-fil-A in Connecticut, mm-hmm. and they only chose 3 people, and she was one of them. So it's she really talks about the tenacity it took and all of the energy that, you know, that she basically didn't take no for an answer. She just kept going to them and saying, here's why I'm the person that you need to let open this franchise. Her talk is really so energetic and amazing. The kids love her, not to mention that she always brings free chicken biscuits, which helps.
Yes.
But she really does talk about, and then she's one of the top three Chick-fil-A's now in the country. In fact, they fly her to all over the country to help open up other Chick-fil-A franchises, and they use her as a best practice.
Well, certainly an incredible trio kicking off the November Entrepreneurial Month. JA Launch Lessons, these hour-long educational experiences built around the theme of entrepreneurship that creates a point of entry for students, volunteers, and educators. It's happening here during National Entrepreneur Month. Entrepreneurship Month, I should say, in November, with the support of Junior Achievement. And we want to thank our guest this morning, Bernadine Vendito, who's president of JA of Greater Fairfield County, and Jennifer Murphy Pitcher, who we just heard from, who's the district director and in charge of programming. If you'd like to learn more about the launch lessons, you can do that by going to ja.org/launch. But of course, if you'd like to learn more about what Junior Achievement of Greater Fairfield County can do for your young people, whether you're part of a local membership group or an educational institution, you can go to jawct.org. And Jennifer and Bernadine, thank you for being on the program this morning, and good luck with Entrepreneurship Month and your launch lesson program here in November. Well, we tap our resources at the American Lung Association often on the award-winning For the People, so seldom does the news come that is so good, interesting, and promising in the face of the fact that lung cancer is still the nation's leading cause of cancer deaths for both women and men. And right here in Connecticut, almost 3,000 new diagnoses of lung cancer are going to be happening before the end of 2018. But there's an opportunity to turn the tide against this deadly disease, and we're going to be talking about it today. I was just chatting with our guest this morning, Dr. David Hill. But before I opened up his bio, I thought we might be chatting with him, in Colorado or Washington or in Texas. And in fact, he is right here in Connecticut. He's on the board of directors for the American Lung Association, and he's the scientific and medical editorial review panel national spokesperson and the director of clinical research for Waterbury Pulmonary Associates. It's very exciting to both know that we have such a great resource here in the state of Connecticut, but also that we can tap right here on the program to help folks that are listening, especially those who may be touched by lung cancer. He's an assistant clinical professor of medicine at Yale University School of Medicine and an assistant clinical professor at the Frank Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, as well as a clinical instructor at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. So, David, the trifecta of educational institutions here, and you play a role in all of them, plus your practice and the American Lung Association. I trust once in a while you have time for sleep or a meal.
it keeps me busy, but I do sleep occasionally, and I'm glad to be available to share this important information with your listeners.
Yeah, well, like I said when we chatted before going on mic, to me, a journalist who reports on medicine, it's not so often that something that appears to be such an important breakthrough happens. So it must really be an exciting time for you and your colleagues when finally some sort of an announcement like a new screening tool for lung cancer is released and available for public use.
Yeah, we're very excited by using low-dose CT scanning to screen for lung cancer. It's something that can really help us catch this disease earlier at a state where we can treat it and cure it. Unfortunately, a vast number of lung cancer patients are diagnosed when the disease is advanced, and low-dose CT scanning allows us to find them earlier, where the likelihood of survival increases substantially.
Well, here during Lung Cancer Awareness Month in November, I know the American Lung Association is very interested in sharing this information and making the general public aware of it. But before we dig into what the test actually is and what it involves, who should seek it, can you talk a little bit, to the extent that you may know, about the development of this test? Has this been something that's kind of been mulling in the laboratory and test setting for a long time? And did any of the universities or locations that you're involved with play a role prior to this being sanctioned for actual use for the public?
So some of the research was done here in Connecticut at Yale. The large studies that have been done are both large national studies and international studies looking at a substantial number of patients. So the data is really strong in specific populations that screening can, again, identify cancers early and potentially save lives.
So tell us a little bit about, to the extent that you know or were involved, how was this developed? Was this an idea that came about some time ago, or is this a relatively new and quick development in your world?
Well, I've been in practice for over 20 years, and we've been seeking a method to screen and identify lung cancer really for longer than my career. Looking at things like chest x-rays or sputum samples that patients cough up, and none of those techniques have been successful in finding cancers early. The CT scan, traditional CT scans, carry not a large radiation load, but enough that doing routine regular CT scans would be, potentially risky. The low-dose CT scan that's been developed has about 10% of the radiation of a normal CT scan. So it's a much lower radiation dose and much safer for the patient. And really, it's been the improvement in CT scan technology that allows us to use a lower radiation dose but still get really good images of the lung so that we can identify abnormalities at a much earlier stage.
So looking across the landscape here in Connecticut with 2,700 plus new diagnoses of lung cancer anticipated before the end of 2018, in a perfect world, if all of those 2,700 plus individuals were to be able to have this screening, do the various practices in Connecticut who could do it have the technology and capacity to actually handle that patient load?
We do. I think we're very lucky in Connecticut. We've got excellent university and community hospitals, and screening is actually available throughout the state at multiple centers. I know both hospitals here in Waterbury offer a screening program. Certainly all of the major cities have them available. And then if abnormalities are found, we've got excellent clinical care facilities where patients can be evaluated and treated. So certainly the capacity is there. The ability to save lives is something we have to have the capacity for.
Well, let's drill into that. I'm seeing a 56% figure here. Can you tease that out a little bit and give us a little bit more perspective on the potential for this to either save or prolong lives for individuals who do come forward, have the test, and it proves positive?
Yeah, so certainly when we find lung cancer in stage one, where it hasn't spread, that gives us a substantial advantage in being able to treat it and cure it, usually with surgery, sometimes with just targeted radiation therapy. As the stage advances, the likelihood of us being able to cure the disease and have patients survive 5 years or more really goes down, and that's where screening comes in. The lungs, unfortunately, don't have a lot of nerves, so patients don't feel anything when they develop a lung cancer until it's gotten to be large or spread somewhere else. The only way we identify it early is really with imaging, and that's where the CAT scan comes in.
Mm. And as in most cases with newly developed procedures and technologies, as we stand here today, only about 5 out of every 100 people who are eligible or potentially predisposed to lung cancer due to genetics or lifestyle, what have you, are currently accessing this test, right?
Correct. You know, so the test itself is targeted at a specific high-risk population. You know, I'll point out that, anyone can get lung cancer. Sort of the risk for getting lung cancer is having lungs.
Yes.
And no one deserves lung cancer. About 15% of lung cancers now are in never smokers. And the screening tests that we have available with low-dose CT scan is specifically targeted at patients between the ages of 55 and 80 who have what's called a 30-pack-year smoking history. So they had smoked the equivalent of a pack a day for 30 years or 2 packs a day for 15 years. Those patients have to have either continued to smoke or stopped within the past 15 years in order to be eligible for screening. And so it's a narrow group of patients, but it's still a substantial number of people, and we're still under-screening that population.
Well, we're going to come back and talk more about this and the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative to help raise awareness, as we're doing. And I guess as a result of this call, you know, Dr. David Hill, who is the national spokesperson and on the board of directors for the American Lung Association, I should say the national spokesperson for the Scientific and Medical Editorial Review Panel of the American Lung Association, is with us. We're going to be back to talk with him more about this exciting and incredible new development in screening for lung cancer, the many lives that could potentially be saved or prolonged as a result of it. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Access Health CT wants you to know that the 2019 open enrollment period for health plan coverage has begun. Connecticut residents can buy or renew health insurance plans only until December 15th, with their coverage starting on January 1st. Access Health CT customers with a 2018 plan have been notified if they are eligible to be auto-enrolled into a new plan for 2019. Changes to plans for 2019 could mean changes to monthly payments, however, as well as deductibles and other areas related to the plans, which is why it's important to shop and compare plans this year before enrolling. Learn more, shop, compare, and enroll on the Access Health CT website at accesshealthct.com. And click on Compare Plans.
Well, thanks for sticking with us. And if you're just joining us, we are visiting with Dr. David Hill. He's on the board of directors and the Scientific and Medical Editorial Review Panel, as well as a national spokesperson for the American Lung Association. It's exciting times for folks who are working in the medical industry, particularly those who are doing lung cancer research, diagnosis, and treatment as the new study, I should say the new screening tool that has been developed and is now available has the potential to save or prolong the lives of the little under 3,000 Connecticut residents who are going to be diagnosed with lung cancer this year and into the future. So, Dr. Hill, you were talking a little bit before we went on the break about the specific folks who are eligible for the test, but you did also mention that anyone can get it, and certainly, you know, one of the most frustrating things for me has been the half a dozen or so people in my life who have lost their lives from lung cancer, and virtually all of them were either never heavy smokers or never smoked at all. And I'm sure from your perspective, when you have to have that talk with a patient and they say, I've never smoked in my life and never thought I was exposed to any kind of carcinogen that would cause lung cancer, that's got to be incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I think it's frustrating anytime we have to tell anyone they have lung cancer.
Yeah.
You know, we unfortunately have, you know, a long history of smoking in this country, along with exposures to other risk factors that can lead to cancer. So it never really is an easy conversation to have with a patient, regardless of their risk factors. But, you know, again, there's some exciting developments both in screening and treatment that we feel can be helpful to anyone who has lung cancer.
Great. Well, before we talk about the Lung Force Initiative, if we could drill back into and remind people who are most likely and eligible for this new screening. You mentioned something about 30 pack years before we went on to the break. Can you expand on that a little bit and talk also to those who may be predisposed to lung cancer who aren't specifically cigarette smokers, if that in fact is the case?
Yeah, I think it's important for people who feel they, you know, they have risks to speak with their physician in terms of what testing should be done, how they should be followed. You know, for low-dose CT scans right now, we have those specific guidelines that talk about definitely the high-risk smoking or former smoker population. The good news is there's a lot of work being done to develop other potential screening methods, both based on imaging or based on potentially genetic markers for tumors that may help screening for some of the other at-risk populations as time goes on. So people are looking at genetic markers in blood or in sputum or even in exhaled breath that may help identify people earlier and allow for earlier treatment.
So for individuals who go for a physical, is this going to be a situation where now they're going to be asked a little bit more specifically about their smoking history in order to identify them and possibly qualify them or qualify a recommendation for them to get the screening?
Yes, I think it's, you know, certainly important whenever somebody's seeing, you know, whether it's their primary care physician or specialist, that their smoking history is well quantified. This specific availability of screening with the current guidelines for who qualifies certainly should make providers sort of drill down to determine are patients eligible to have screening done.
And I see there's also an online tool or site where people can go to actually determine whether or not they're at a higher risk factor before they even see their physician.
Correct. So if you go to our website, savedbythescan.org, there's a quiz available there that you can enter some personal information, and it'll let you know whether you meet the guidelines for screening. It also actually has links that will let you know where local screening centers are, so that you can talk to your own provider about it, or you could call one of the local screening centers and speak to them.
Great. And there's also a partnership at the professional level with the American Thoracic Society.
Correct. The American Thoracic Society, which is one of the leading pulmonary organizations in the world, has worked hand-in-hand with the American Lung Association to develop screening guidelines to actually train physicians and hospitals how to develop screening programs so that more people can get screened. It's estimated that currently about 8 million Americans would qualify for screening. And if we were to screen all of them, we'd save at least 25,000 lives. So it's a substantial amount of people we can help.
Excellent. Well, you did mention briefly some research that's on the horizon. So in the last few minutes that we have with you, can you talk a little bit about what you're learning about things that are going on either at the three educational institutions where you are affiliated or across the nation or perhaps even globally? What's on the horizon that's continuing to keep you and your colleagues in the fight against lung cancer and lung cancer deaths going every day?
So I think I talked a little about screening. There are multiple tests in the works, again, looking at genetic markers via blood or other body fluid samples, sometimes combined with CT scan screening. And that form of testing may help us identify people who are at higher risk and should be either screened more frequently or watched more carefully. And that's sort of one exciting area. On the treatment side, there's a lot of new therapies being developed based on genetic mutations which lung cancer tumors can have, and this allows for targeted therapy in patients who have more advanced disease. And we're seeing some patients who have advanced disease that in former years would really be a death sentence, survive long-term with some of these targeted therapies. So there's a lot of excitement in the lung cancer treatment area. But the most important thing we can do is find lung cancer early so that we can treat it early and really do our best to avoid risk factors. So tobacco control, preventing people from starting smoking, helping people to stop smoking, controlling air pollution and other risk factors, testing your home for radon, all of those things are really important in decreasing lung cancer risk.
And before we close, I mean, you said you've been in this field for more than two decades. I see here that just in the past 4 years, there's been an explosion of research, and that means a significant step up in the amount of underwriting for this research. So it really seems that even in the short run, this level of expanded research is really paying off, first and foremost, delivering this new screening tool.
Yes, you know, and I think I have to say with some pride that the American Lung Association, through their Lung Force Initiative, has really played a role in this. We've really worked hard to raise awareness of how prominent lung cancer is as a, you know, leading cancer killer in both men and women. And we've really lobbied to help increase NIH funding for cancer research to develop new screening tools and new treatments and cures.
Excellent. Well, our listeners can certainly help support the cause. Certainly, we are seeing the results in this discussion that we had this morning and with some of the tests that are on the horizon that are dealing with genetic markers and such. If folks want to learn more, they can either web search the American Lung Association in Connecticut or go to lung.org. There is an upcoming Fight for Air Climb Hartford and the Lung Force Walk in Hartford coming up that could use your participation. And if you go to lung.org/lung-cancer, you can learn a lot more about lung cancer and this screening initiative that we talked about on the program, as well as share your experiences with the disease if you have them. We want to thank our guest this morning, Dr. David Hill, who's on the board of directors for the American Lung Association, as well as being the scientific and medical editorial review panelist and national spokesperson for the organization. He's based right here in Connecticut. He's director of clinical research for Waterbury Pulmonary Associates. Dr. Hill, thank you so much for all the great information this morning, and I'm sure now that we know you're close by and that so much other exciting research is poised to deliver new screenings and ways of saving people from lung cancer death, we're going to be talking to you again very soon. So thank you so much for your time this morning. Well, as we move into the earlier part of the holiday season, there's a lot going on to consider, a lot of activities. And, you know, I remember my first trip to the Mark Twain House in Hartford these many, many decades ago. And the Mark Twain House is still a really, really incredible place for folks young and old. The Mark Twain House and Museum has restored the author's Hartford home, where Mark Twain and his family lived from 1874 to 1891. He wrote his most important works during the years he lived there, including Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. In addition to providing tours of Twain's restored home, a National Historic Landmark, the institution offers activities and educational programs that illuminate Twain's literary legacy and provide information about his life and times. And we are so excited to meet and talk with Karen Licht. She is the president of the Friends of the Mark Twain House and a three-time chairperson of the annual Holiday House Tour. Today marks number this year marks number 38, I should say. And that will be coming up on Sunday, December 2nd. So Karen, welcome to the program. Great to make your acquaintance.
Thank you so much. I appreciate having the opportunity to speak to you today.
Well, as somebody who, as I said, has been to the Mark Twain home both as a youth and an adult, and somebody who lives in kind of a, you know, on a much smaller and unimportant scale, a historical home, this is a very exciting interview for me, but I'm most interested in starting out and talking a little bit about you. Do you have a lifelong interest in Mark Twain, in antiquities, in literature, or all of the above?
Actually, all of the above. And I became really interested when I attended the first time that I attended, actually, the house tour that was sponsored by the Friends. And that's what actually got me interested in joining our organization and continuing to be involved with the organization and with the event.
So how long have you been involved with the Friends?
I have been involved with the Friends for the past 9 years.
Very good. So what are a few of the things about the world in and around the Mark Twain House and Museum that you find fascinating, maybe even find new things to be intrigued or love about it every time you get involved or visit?
I think that they're always having a lot of different discussions that take place at the in the museum center itself. Additionally, there are so many things that actually go on within the house. For instance, last year they did a renovation of the mahogany room, which is absolutely exquisite. So for any folks who haven't seen that recently, it's pretty exciting. And in addition to that, they have living history tours, and these are actually tours that are given by supposedly former staff of Sam Clemens, and give you some insights as to exactly what they have seen, and insights into a little bit more about the family. And if you take a tour with Lizzie, who is the busybody maid, but a good busybody person, you'll even get to go downstairs into the basement, and it's hands-on in the basement, so it's kind of a fun place to go.
So you can actually go to the Mark Twain House a number of times within a very short time frame and get completely different, or in some respects, different perspectives and pieces of information, depending on who that tour leader is?
Oh, absolutely. So if you go with Lizzie, you're going to get that perspective. And then you can go with Susie, who is one of the daughters of the Clemenses. You're going to get a different perspective from her also. Or you might go with Livy, who was Sam's wife. So a number of different individuals that can take you through the home and give you their perspective on what happened in the house and who they interacted with and exactly what rooms they might have liked the best.
Mm. So if you're a real Mark Twain devotee or a Twain head, as they sometimes call themselves,
can you actually contact
the museum and find out when each individual guide is doing the tours and assign yourself so that you can experience that full spectrum of presentation?
You can absolutely do that. You just place a call. You can get the museum desk. And when you do, they'll have all the information for you. And you can they can share with you exactly who it is that's going to be doing the tours and give a little bit of background about what those tour guides can actually offer you. So by all means, you can do that so you can plan in advance.
So if somebody's listening to the program and they have younger children, say up to, you know, adolescents up to preteens or young teens, would you advise them to maybe think about aligning with a particular tour guide that might have more information or a style that lends itself more to younger people than adults?
Actually, I think they're all so terrific and they interact so well with all age groups that I would think that regardless of which tour guide or which tour you went on with the tour guide, that you would come away and probably be very satisfied and learn some new things.
Excellent. Well, you talked about the renovations and renewing of the mahogany room, but over the course of your involvement with the Friends, have there been any other relatively new developments, renovations, changes, or things that people might want to know today about visiting the Mark Twain House and Museum if they haven't been there in a decade or two?
Well, I would definitely check on the website, and you can also give a call to the actual museum itself, and you can find out about programs that are being held. There are times when they have programs that are held in Mark Twain's different rooms within the house. I know there's an upcoming program. It's a musical program that's going to be coming up in the next couple of weeks. I don't have the exact date on that, though. But that will be coming up, and so you get a chance to go into the house and listen to a terrific performer and feel as though you're visiting with Mark Twain right there. So programs like that, I think those are really kind of exciting that they offer and can appeal to a really broad group of folks within Hartford and then outside of Hartford also.
Great. Well, before we transition and talk about and invite folks to the 38th annual holiday house tour at the Mark Twain House and Museum, just tell us a little bit more about the group that you're involved with, the Friends of the Mark Twain House. Do you have specific responsibilities and duties above and beyond promoting events like the house tour and probably getting engaged in initiatives that involve fundraising and capital development?
Yes, and actually the Friends, just some background on the Friends of the Mark Twain House and Museum, we're volunteers and we belong, again, to the organization, and we sponsor fundraising events, and we've done that for the past 51 years, and it's solely to benefit the Mark Twain House and Museum. So all of the proceeds from any event that we sponsor is directly for use at the Mark Twain House for whatever they might need as far as any projects that they're working on, for any of their educational programs that they've got. So we have been providing this service for a number of years, and we would love to have new members. So anyone who is interested can certainly reach us at, I'll give you the email.
Mm-hmm.
It's friends, FRIENDSMTH at yahoo.com. And we also have a page on the Mark Twain House website. So you can certainly go there, and there's a link to get you some more information about the Friends.
Very good. And that is simply marktwainhouse.org. We are so pleased, just passing the midpoint of our chat with Karen Licht, who is president of the Friends of the Mark Twain House and chairperson, three-time chairperson of the annual Holiday House Tour. This year marks the 38th annual Holiday House Tour, and it is being put on by the Friends of Mark Twain House and Museum. It's Sunday, December 2nd from 11 to 3. So let's talk more about that in the time that we have left, Karen. Give us the scope of this. It's not just coming in and doing something very similar to what they might do if they come to the Mark Twain House on any other day, right?
Exactly. We have four private homes in addition to the Mark Twain House that folks can visit. And our tickets in advance are $30, and you can go through all of the homes as well as the Mark Twain House on that particular day of the week. And the homes are located in Hartford and also in West Hartford. And the group of homes that we have this year are in very close proximity to each other, so I would say they're probably no more than maybe 2 or 3 miles apart from one another, so very easy to visit them.
So how do the logistics of this work? People first arrive at the Mark Twain House and Museum, and they get a kind of a self-guiding map to these other locations?
Well, what you can do is you can go online, and if you go online, you want to go to marktwainhouse.org, and there is a holiday house tour, and you can go there to actually purchase online. You can also purchase by phone, and I'll give you the number for that. The phone number is 860-280-3130. And if there's no one there to take your message or to take your phone call, you can leave a message, and they will return the call, and they can process your purchases via phone for you. We also have tickets for sale at specific merchants, and one in West Hartford, Cook Shop, Emmylou's in Glastonbury, Moran's Flower Shop in Simsbury, Lane and Linge in West Hartford, and Moscarilla's in West Hartford.
Great. Folks should know also that $30 purchase for the Mark Twain House and Holiday House tour is a discounted price if you purchase them in advance, and you can do that at marktwainhouse.org/holiday-house-tour, but you can also show up on the day of the event if time presents itself. You'll just pay a little bit more. Tickets go up to $35 on the day of the tour. And I know a lot of this it's important to, protect and respect the folks who are volunteering their homes. So without getting into the specifics of where these other four homes are besides at the Mark Twain House, tell us a little bit about what people will be seeing. I see in my notes here that the Mark Twain House will be decorated for the late 19th century Christmas. Does that allude to the fact that each year on the house tour, decorations may represent a different era of time?
Well, it usually is the same for the Mark Twain House. But at our other homes, for instance, we have a house at 1414 in Asylum, and I know that homeowner has extensive decorations. So on their wrought iron fence, they've got a garland, and it's huge. It's on the corner of Asylum Avenue. Mm-hmm. They have wreaths on every one of the windows. It's a two-story home, and they've got a wreath on every window that's in the house. They have 4 to 5 Christmas trees throughout the house, with a variety of different decorations throughout the home. So everyone will be able to see that, maybe get some ideas for how they might want to decorate for the holiday also. And and our other homeowners, their homes will be decorated also based upon whatever their holiday that they celebrate. So again, you'll see a number of Christmas decorations.
Great. Well, whether you get your advance tickets for $30 or the premium tickets on the day of the tour, if available, for $35, it is important to reiterate that proceeds from the tour benefit the continued restoration, preservation, and educational programs of the Mark Twain House and Museum that I enjoyed as a youth and as an adult, and so many people have, traveling really from all points around the globe to Hartford to see this, the birthplace of the literature that is so critical to our upbringing and the books that virtually are read world round, sometimes over and over again, that were written by Mark Twain. Before we close with you, Karen, if folks are already booked on Sunday, December 2nd, are the friends of the Mark Twain House and Museum already in the works planning any other activities for 2019 that we'd like to maybe put on the calendar?
I don't have any that are actually finalized at this time, but I would say to stay tuned and to continue to review the Mark Twain House website and specifically go to the Friends. So we've got a page on there. So you can go directly there. And also they'll be on the calendar at the Mark Twain House. So you can certainly follow up that way to
Excellent.
See what we might have planned.
Yeah, and for folks that might have tuned in late to the interview, Karen did indicate earlier in the program that the Friends of the Mark Twain House and Museum are eager and would love to have you as a friend as well. So you can go to their website and learn all about it. Once again, the 38th annual Holiday House Tour at the Mark Twain House and Museum will feature the Mark Twain House as well as four unique private homes in West Hartford and Hartford. The tour advance tickets are $30. Each $35 on the day if available, and you can call 860-280-3130 or go to marktwainhouse.org/holiday-house-tour to get your tickets in advance and save a few bucks. Maybe throw that extra $5 that you save into the donation tray, and all proceeds benefit the continued restoration, preservation, and educational programs of the Mark Twain House and Museum. So pleased to meet you, Karen Licht, president of the Friends of the Mark Twain House and a three-time chairperson of the annual Holiday House Tour. Happy holidays to you, and we hope that the tour, as always, is near or completely sold out, and that you endear another generation of folks to not only the Mark Twain House and Museum, but to all of the efforts of the Friends that you represent. Thank you so much, and great to meet you. We'll see you on the house tour.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.